When we were growing up, most concussions went undiagnosed and untreated. Even the terminology was pretty lighthearted. You might have said someone really got clonked and was out cold, or that collision was a bell ringer, or when she went down, she saw stars. Of course, we now know a great deal more about concussions, what kind of damage they cause, and how to best treat them. But there is still a great deal researchers don't know. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn the very latest on this rapidly changing field. If you or one of your kids had a concussion even a year ago, you might be surprised how much more information is out there and how treatment options have changed. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. And this is Maine Calling. It seems every week there's an important new study about concussions. In this week's journal Pediatrics, the study was about the academic effects of concussions. The week before, the Journal of the American Medical Association reported that kids are more likely to get concussions in practice than during games. Today, we're going to learn more about the very latest in diagnosing, treating, and preventing concussions, and about important research underway here in Maine. With me in our studio, Dr. Michelle Labatz is a sports medicine physician with InterMed. Dr. Paul Berkner is co-founder of the Maine Concussion Management Initiative at Colby College. Laura McGrath, a physical therapist with CAPE Physical Therapy. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about concussions? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. And before we get into the very latest research, I want to talk about some basics. Dr. Berkner, what is a concussion?
So a concussion is a brain injury that occurs not at a structural level. So we're, historically, we think about brain injuries as having bleeding into the brain or structural damage. This is actually damage that occurs at a cellular level as opposed to a structural level. And it occurs from a twisting or a turning or a movement of the brain within the vault of your head. So think about an egg yolk within an egg shell. As you move the egg yolk tends to move inside of it. It's when it moves inside, when the brain accelerates and decelerates, that it actually hits or is twisted, and that's what causes a concussion. And those injuries, are not big, large structural changes. They're just changes that occur at a cellular level. So you can't see them on a CT or an MRI or any type of imaging that we currently have that's readily available to the public.
Well, you say you can't see them on a CT or an MRI. Dr. Labatz, how does one diagnose a concussion then?
Well, the diagnosis of a concussion is what we call a clinical diagnosis, where, like you said, there's really no tests that we can do to make a definitive diagnosis. So it's really based upon an appropriate history, somebody who had either a direct injury to the head or what we call an indirect injury, where an injury that maybe caused some head movement, as Dr. Berkner discussed, and then an appropriate constellation of symptoms afterwards. So it's really symptoms within the correct history of an appropriate stressor to the brain. And when we see that, we make the diagnosis of a concussion. It's a very broad spectrum of diagnosis. We call it, it has a high degree of sensitivity, meaning that we might actually be over-diagnosing some concussions, but there are probably also a lot of concussions that are still being missed.
And one thing I learned recently is that we no longer grade the severity of concussions, one of the many new things about concussions. Why is that?
We found that you can't really tell the severity of a concussion until after it's over, and then you kind of look at it retrospectively. So right now we almost think of concussion like pregnancy. You either are or you aren't, and we really kind of leave any type of grading or determination of severity for kind of after the fact when you look back and you say, yeah, that was a pretty bad one, or no, you got over that pretty well.
Laura McGrath, I think a lot of people would find it very interesting that a physical therapist is involved in this discussion. Most people, I think, don't even know that there is such a thing as physical therapy for concussions. Why don't you talk to me a little bit about treatment? If a student athlete has come to you with a concussion, what are you what are you thinking about? How can I treat this child?
Yeah, well, when an athlete has some symptoms associated with a concussion, usually headaches or dizziness or balance issues that aren't resolving in that typical amount of time that one would hope, like in that 2-week period of time when those symptoms are persisting, physical therapy is a great kind of tool. And what we do, kind of like other injuries in the body, is we try to facilitate healing. And so if you look at the analogy of like an ankle sprain, we're all sort of familiar with that injury where there's a significant amount of swelling associated with that. And the inflammation is really a healing process that the body has that's natural. And when these cells that or these chemicals that are released causing this swelling, are their job is to absorb those damaged cells and to try to kind of create an environment for healing. And the problem is when that inflammation stage kind of lingers, and we call that stasis, where these chemicals and this inflammation sort of sits there, and these symptoms persist over time. And so what we do in physical therapy is we try to sort of jumpstart that healing process and move beyond that chronic inflammation and get the body to kind of absorb those chemicals so that those symptoms aren't triggered. So in the head, it's those headaches and maybe dizziness. For the ankle, it's not being able to put weight through it or walk.
It's so interesting that you talk about chemicals. Is this something that's fairly new knowledge, that a concussion is in part an injury involving chemicals in the brain?
I think it is. I think Paul, you could speak more to that.
I think, in fact, we've known for a long time. There were some early Sentinel articles that came out in the early 2000s that looked at the specific chemical changes that are occurring in the brain, and they were based on rat modeling. The problem is that we took that rat model and we expanded it out to humans, and I think one of the things that we're seeing now is a clear change in how we manage concussions based on what we were talking about just a second ago, about the fact that we really need to not just rest the brain. Physical therapy, we used to just rest everything. Well, now we don't. We have physical therapists who actively engage the affected area, and this is the same with the brain. We need to engage it in a very structured, very safe format, but that's what we're changing. And so as we know more, we change how we're managing it. And that's really the dynamic part, and why we're all involved in managing concussions and talking about them, is because things are changing. As we sit here, things are changing, and we really need to be kept up on how to manage concussions on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I know young people who have a concussion even a year or two ago are told, sit quietly in a dark room, no television. And now, Laura, you're helping children, okay, get your blood pressure up, get your heart rate up a little bit, move.
Yeah, so when you elevate your heart rate, the theory is you're getting blood to the brain, and we're trying to flush out some of these chemicals that are lingering, as we said, and sort of responsible for these symptoms that are ongoing. And so we try to educate people on how to incorporate cardiovascular exercise initially. And it's tricky because sometimes people with post-concussion syndrome have elevated heart rates, and it's part of the whole chemical interaction with the brain that's gone awry. And so we try to teach them how to increase their heart rate in a safe way that doesn't trigger these symptoms that we're trying to address. And that's called sub-symptom threshold exercise. And so we put them on a bicycle, a stationary bike that's very kind of controlled, and we give them a heart rate monitor or teach them how to monitor their heart rate. And we try to have them elevate their heart rate to a point where just their symptom, maybe their headache, is just starting. And then we say, okay, let's look at what your heart rate is right now. And let's try to stay a little bit below that. And let's work in that range where we're getting your heart rate up and we're getting blood flow to your brain, but we're not provoking your symptoms. And we try to increase their tolerance to that and build their tolerance to a higher heart rate so that it normalizes their body's ability to exercise and doesn't trigger these symptoms.
Michelle Abbas, I think for many parents whose child has a concussion, it's a really scary thing. And we've heard so much about, what's going on with the NFL and football players who are affected for the rest of their lives. The question comes up, does somebody ever heal from a concussion? Can you heal from a concussion?
Well, the thinking is that you can recover from a concussion. You can return back to your prior level of, academic performance and athletic performance. But the thinking is that there's probably some degree of permanent injury at the cellular level, as Dr. Berkner was saying, that probably never fully recovers. And that probably creates an additional vulnerability to future injury. So we know that past concussion is one of the biggest predictors of a future concussion. We know that people who have had multiple concussions tend to have a more difficult time recovery. So there probably is, at the cellular level, kind of almost at that microscopic level, there probably is some degree of damage that persists. But the function, the way somebody lives their day-to-day life and does school and sports, we always, you know, initially expect and hope that concussed kids will be able to come back fully. But there is still that little bit of damage there that creates, again, that vulnerability to future issues.
Paul Berkner, you are one of the founders of the Maine Concussion Management Initiative, 6 years old now. What are the goals of your project, and where are we now? What kind of things are you doing?
So we started out as a way to start engaging our community, especially at the high school level, around the best practices for concussion management, which had been coming out over the past 10 years, and we really felt, Joe Atkins and Bill Hines and myself, felt we really needed to bring this to the high school levels. And so that's where we started. Our goal is primarily to reduce concussions in activity-related concussions across the state. Where are we at? We're moving along. I think we have a long way to go. I think one of our ongoing problems is just trying to figure out where sort of what we know. And so that's one of the big focuses over the next couple of years, is to really understand how many concussions occur within the state. No one really has a good understanding about how many concussions occur. And right now, my big worry is that concussions are tagged as a sports issue, when in fact they're a life injury. These occur in multiple facets across every child's life, and by tagging it as an athlete issue, then we may say, okay, we'll stop doing athletics. And I don't think that that's correct. I really want to make sure that we understand truly the scope of concussions across the whole lifespan for our young adults.
So let me build on that a little bit. You said it can be an anybody issue. If my child, and I'll direct this to you, Michelle, if my child falls in the kitchen and clonks his or her head on the countertop, how do I know whether or not I should bring that child into the doctor and be tested for a concussion?
Well, that's a question that parents come up against all of the time. You know, at what point do you have a head injury that's severe enough to warrant kind of medical intervention? And the tricky thing about that with concussion is that the symptoms are kind of evanescent. They tend to evolve. So a lot of times you'll have somebody who hits their head in a variety of circumstances, and maybe the initial symptoms aren't so bad, but over the period of a couple of hours, they'll maybe develop some visual changes, they'll develop some nausea, some vomiting. And a lot of times, you know, kids get injured during the day at school, and by the time these other kind of scarier symptoms come up, it's oftentimes the evening, and that's when things can get a little nerve-wracking because you don't have access to your doctor. So if you're in doubt, if you have a kid who has kind of a worsening set of symptoms, it would certainly behoove you to at least pick up the phone and talk to your primary care provider and see if it's something that warrants either going in and seeking out urgent care or, you know, possibly can wait till the next morning. But it is not uncommon to see kind of these changing, evolving symptoms over the first couple hours or first couple days of a concussion. But there's really no hard and fast rules. It's really on a case-by-case basis.
Are there certain things, for example, he got knocked out or he saw stars? Are there certain things in which in every case when X happens, yeah, call your doctor? Maybe not.
Yeah.
Well, I think that if somebody has loss of consciousness, they should get evaluated.
Yeah.
I think the other side of that is that over 90% of concussions occur without loss of consciousness. So 10 or 15 years ago, we used to use loss of consciousness as one of the things that said you had a concussion. That happens so very rarely in concussions that I think that's the flip side of that. But certainly if your child is knocked out, I think the other thing is your age of your child. If you have a child under the age of 10, you need to pay attention more. If you have the child under the age of 5 or 6, again, those, they are more likely to have more severe injury. What we're really worried about in those cases are, do they have structural changes? Do they have structural bleeding problems that have occurred that we may miss? And so that's the sort of the acute phase. And then the longer phase stuff is really about, how are they doing? How are they feeling? And how comfortable are the parents? You know, if there's ever a question, as a pediatrician, always call your pediatrician, because they're the people who are going to be able to help you in the moment.
All right. Well, believe it or not, we already have to take a quick break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're talking about concussions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Revision Energy, celebrating spring by helping Mainers generate clean, renewable solar electricity. More at revisionenergy.com. And Sweetser, seeking mentors to support children with mental and behavioral health needs. Training and support provided. Learn more at sweetser.org.
This week on NPR's Morning Edition, we take a historical journey through the arts from a man who was obsessed with collecting Shakespeare.
He guarded his secret about how many copies he had.
To the world's oldest movie theater.
This historic cinema house has been showing movies for the last 120 years.
Find out where we take you next on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us weekdays from 6 to 9 here on MPBN Radio. Every day you hear messages about local businesses and organizations that provide their financial support to MPBN. They all understand the value of MPBN in our community and have decided to make public radio and television a part of their marketing effort. If you would like to learn what these folks already know, visit mpbn.net and click on Business Support to find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions, and contact information. Or you can just call us, 800-884-1717. As always, thank you for your support of public broadcasting in Maine.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the latest on our understanding of concussions. With us in the studio, Dr. Paul Berkner is co-founder of the Maine Concussion Management Initiative at Colby College. Dr. Michelle Labatz is a sports medicine physician at Intermed. And also, Michelle, you're on the board of the American Academy of Pediatrics Sports Medicine Committee, correct?
Yep.
And Laura McGrath is a physical therapist and founder of CAPE Physical Therapy. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to start by going to Edie. Hi, Edie. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. My son had a concussion a couple of weeks ago. He's a college student, and I feel like he's kind of taking one step forward, two steps back. But I had a couple of questions. One is that I've read that a concussion, they think that there may be a disruption in nerve endings, and that can be what is causing the headache. So I was wondering if that's the case and if there's just kind of an intermittent mild headache, if that is something where you could just take Tylenol and then it's not such a huge deal.
Michelle Abbas, this is pretty common, the one step forward, two steps back, or at least, that you know, it's not a steady progression often, correct?
Yeah, very common. It's often kind of in a wave form where there'll be some good days and there'll be some bad days. And oftentimes, as Laura was mentioning and Paul as well, that you try to find the sweet spot in terms of the right amount of both cognitive or academic activity and the right amount of physical activity. If you don't do enough, you're going to start heading in the wrong direction. And if you overdo it, you're going to head in the wrong direction. So there's this kind of sweet spot. And it's not hard for me to imagine how a college student with, I imagine this time of year, there's probably a lot of academic pressure, a lot of social action, that not hard to imagine how he might get into that situation of either overdoing it or underdoing it and setting him back. And Edie, when you say that about the disruption at the end of the nerve cells, and that's kind of going back to what Dr. Berkner was saying, where the injury actually happens at the nerve level. And when they talk about the disruption at the end of the nerve cells, they're talking about the way the nerve cells talk to each other. And there's some chemicals that communicate back and forth. And those are what get disrupted. And we think that that plays a very large role in the symptoms of concussion.
Okay. Edie, does that answer your question?
Yes, but I have two more. Can they tell me about post-concussion? What's the difference between exactly what is post-concussion syndrome and what's its relevance?
So Edie, post-concussion syndrome is where the symptoms continue to occur after what we consider to be the normal period of time. And there is no definition at this point in time. It used to be 6 months. Now it's probably 2 months, somewhere in the 1 to 2 month range. People who have persisting symptoms, especially those sort of low-grade mild headaches, are very common. The headache is the most common symptom that they have. And it means that they're still not healed. I think that that's the point, is that, as Michelle talked about earlier, there is some microscopic damage or cellular damage that's occurred, and that has not yet healed. And I think it's just the fact that there are certain individuals who are at increased risk for not recovering quickly from a concussion. We really don't know what the long-term risk for concussions are. We have some really scary data that's coming out of the NFL, what's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. That's very scary for parents. I don't think that we at this point in time can translate that into our young adults. I think we really have to give us some time to really figure that piece out. But post-concussion syndrome usually is about 2 to 3, at least that's the definition I use, usually have symptoms for about 2 to 3 months.
Okay. Edie, thank you. You said you had a couple more questions. Is that it?
No. I guess, is computer use ill-advised at that point, 2 to 3 months?
This is an interesting question, because a couple years ago you all would have answered yes, but I have a feeling the answer is not going to be yes anymore. Dr. Lavatz.
So hard to imagine taking the computer away from a college student. And again, there can be some symptoms that come on with computer use. I will tell you, oftentimes what I will advise my patients is that if they have to be on the computer to get schoolwork done or for other necessary activity, okay to go through that if your symptoms stay kind of in that mild to moderate range, as long as you feel like you can still kind of function with them. If you stay on the computer long enough and the symptoms ramp up to the point where you would call the symptoms severe or kind of maybe more than a 5 or 6 on a 10-point scale, then it's time to kind of take a break from the computer. And oftentimes that's what we'll have people do, is we'll have them spend, chunks of time on the computer and then take a rest time away. Computer use is often also the way younger people these days maintain their social connections. And we've come to find that especially once you're a couple weeks in, maybe even a couple months in, and you aren't back to your normal activity, that oftentimes this is a very isolating type of injury and can evolve into a depression type of situation. And maintaining social contacts with computer use can be a very helpful way to really keep some of that minimized.
It sounds like that all what you're saying, Michelle, is that kids should really be in tune with themselves and know what triggers their symptoms and really pay attention to whether or not, in their own case, being on the computer for 15 minutes, 30 minutes, or an hour makes them feel worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And the same holds true for reading. The same actually even holds true for time in the classroom, that if the symptoms are just very mild, I don't think you have to be hypervigilant, and I don't tell people they have to be perfectly back to normal. A little bit of discomfort is okay. But if you find that the symptoms are starting to kind of get more aggravating and to the point where you can't function with what you're trying to do, then you're not doing anybody any favors by staying put. You need to kind of step away from it, take a break, give yourself some time to recover, and then re-engage either with the computer or reading or what have you.
Well, Edie, thank you for your questions and good luck with your son. Dr. Bergner, kind of related, we're talking about when someone can go on a computer, but when can an athlete go back to sports? That's changing, isn't it?
When you think about
a concussion? No,
in fact, that's the one thing that is not changing, that athletes are only allowed to go back to athletic activity. They can go back to activities, sort of structured, very structured activity, but they cannot return to their sports until they are totally symptom-free. And totally symptom-free with stress. So in other words, as there's what's called the graduate return to play, which is where we gradually increase their activity level to maximize their heart rate to see if they have any symptoms. And that's critical, that no one who has an ongoing concussion or has any symptoms left over should be allowed to play. It's always a question when you get into the post-concussion syndrome. So what happens when you have a person who's 6 to 9 months out and still having minimal symptoms? They shouldn't go back to activity. I do have one caveat. This is for contact or collision activity. So this is for football, soccer, basketball. We do allow people to do non-collision or non-contact activity as they can get back into it.
Okay. And Laura McGrath, we were talking earlier about physical therapy, and you were talking about, you know, that sweet spot in which somebody's getting their heart rate up, but not so much it triggers symptoms. But there are other things you do as well, depending on what the symptoms of the concussion are, correct? How could a treatment differ for somebody with one set of symptoms and somebody with another set of symptoms?
Yes, that's true. So if someone comes to me and their primary symptom is dizziness or balance issues, cardiovascular exercise plays a role, but there's also a really important piece called vestibular ocular rehab. And what that involves is when people turn their head quickly, or like take someone in their office who's on their computer and they're turning their head for a different task back and forth, and that elicits that sort of fuzzy feeling in their head or dizziness, that's considered a vestibular ocular dysfunction. And these chemicals that we're talking about, they can disrupt the communication between the brain and in your eyes and the brain and your vestibular system. And so we have specific sets of exercises that tries to address this problem. And they're kind of a progression where you initially start in a really controlled environment with someone sitting in a chair and you have them weight shift, and the vestibular system is supposed to adjust for that with eye movement. So if I turn my head to the right, my vestibular system is going to tell my eyes to move a certain distance to the left, and it kind of makes me feel balanced. And if that's not happening correctly, you can feel dizzy from just head movement. And so these exercises try to give input to the brain in this way, but in a very controlled manner. So you're shifting in the chair and you're turning your head and you're moving your eyes, and we're trying not to elicit symptoms. And so we try to find the perfect exercises in a chair that don't make you dizzy but involve eye and head movement. And then once that's tolerated, we move up to standing. And then we progress to balance exercises that are more challenging with coordination, and we throw a ball at people so that they have to focus with their eyes on the ball while they're balancing on one leg. And so we're kind of ramping up the input to the brain and the vestibular system. And eventually over time, it's great because these people adapt and their vestibular systems start to figure out how to work more correctly.
And reconnect. So interesting. Yes. Going to Susan in Orono now. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hello. Well, I actually suffered a concussion about 10 years ago, and I had all the, you know, severe symptoms of migraines and dizziness and vision issues. And I found I really wasn't taken seriously, and it was really frustrating. And I did have a CAT scan. They said there was no damage, but yet I had this continuation of symptoms, and I did have, I went through the physical therapy for about 6 weeks, and it helped with the migraines, but I've had since then long-term effects of now having problems with math and short-term memory. So I'm just curious, like, I guess, is that common? And what other information for the long-term effects?
Sure. And, you know, Susan, I'm sure you're not alone, that a lot of people listening to this program have had a concussion in the past, whether it's 20 years ago or 10 years ago, before there was sort of all the information there is now. Michelle, you were nodding when she was asking her question.
Yeah, 10 years ago, boy, it was very different to an experience in a concussion back then than it is now, because concussions certainly there wasn't as wide an awareness of what a concussion was. And concussions, even now with all we know about it, I have a lot of my patients come back and they feel they're not getting credit for their injury, because it's not like they're walking out of my office with a cast on. Nobody can see how impaired they are and how impaired they feel. So it can be a very isolating injury. And you talk about kind of these migraines, and one thing that I'm finding, I'm not sure about you, Dr. Berkner, but concussions seem to be this unmasker where somebody who maybe had a predisposition to a certain type of headache pattern, or maybe even attention deficit, or maybe anxiety or depression, but maybe they never had those symptoms before. Once they get a concussion, sometimes the concussion can kind of peel away whatever protective layer that patient had, and they have this new problem that emerges that takes on a separate life above and beyond the concussion itself, and you end up having to treat it separately. And I've had a number of patients like you with these migraine patterns, and it's beyond the treatment just for concussion. You end up either talking to your doctor or neurologist about treatments specific for the migraine. And then once the rest of the concussion goes away, you're left with this new thing. It's like the concussion gave you a present that you really didn't want.
You know, it's interesting. Well, the conversation is going in this direction because Dr. Berkner, I met up with somebody you work with, Hannah Willihan, at South Portland High School. We actually have a video of that on the Main Calling Facebook page and on the Main Calling website. But one of the things I noticed in the data that she is trying to gather for the Main Concussion Management Initiative on the questionnaire, is there a history of migraine? Is there a history of ADHD? Really surprising to me. Are you seeing a correlation between migraine and ADHD and concussion?
Absolutely. Those are.
Actually, I would like to actually interject just a moment. I don't have like the migraines went away after the physical therapy, but since then I have been diagnosed with ADHD. So
wow.
In the last like 3 years.
So again, we have increased recognition in adults with attention deficit disorder. So that's happening much more often than it did certainly 10 years ago. Back to your original question, concussions are, if you have attention deficit disorder or a history of migraines or learning disabilities, your risk for getting a concussion and having sustained symptoms from a concussion are increased. And so that's why we're asking those questions. Our goal here is to really try to identify where, as I talked about earlier, the incidents, where are the places that are outliers? Who has the highest rates of concussions? And then can we look at those places and find systematic changes that we can make within their programs that allow us to reduce the rate of concussions? Because what I'm seeing is when I talk to people, every provider that I talk to is being overwhelmed with concussions right now. Everybody is seeing an increase. Part of that is increased awareness. Part of it is the fact that I really believe we're seeing an increased rate of concussions. Athletes and those and individuals are doing sports all year round. They're doing single sports. They're doing it faster. They're stronger. All of those things combine, I think, to actually an increase in concussions. But I really want to look at, can we look at some things we can do structurally within our programs to change concussions? Can we really start reducing the number of concussions that occur? Some of it is rules changes. Some of it is coaching. I don't think equipment, and I want to talk a little bit about equipment, I don't think equipment is really part of this. There's a lot of money being spent on gadgets, helmets, the full 90 for soccer. I don't think that any of those really, none of those at this point in time have been shown to reduce concussions. And so it's really not about the helmet wear. I think it's really about how we're practicing, what we're doing, how we're coaching, how we're officiating around these injuries.
All right. Well, on that note, we'll take another short break. This is going very quickly. Our discussion on concussions, more of your comments and questions when we return. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella. Committed to a safe, efficient disposal of non-recyclable waste for all 16 Maine counties. Casella, giving resources new life.
When former NBC News anchor Tom Brokaw got diagnosed with multiple myeloma, a blood cancer, he knew he wanted to keep it private and prevent headlines like,
Tom Brokaw has cancer, outcome uncertain.
But he's now in remission and has written a new memoir about his diagnosis and how it's changed his life. Brokaw joins us on the next Fresh Air.
Join us this evening at 7 o'clock. And coming up this afternoon on Ideas from the CBC at 1 o'clock, Peace in Their Time. In 1915, more than 1,000 women gathered in The Hague, Netherlands, to find a way to end the First World War. They were social and labor reformers, suffragists, and peace activists, and they were determined to create a plan they could take to the world. Ideas traces the remarkable story of their achievement and defeat. That's coming up just after Maine Calling at 1 o'clock.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Diagnosing and Treating Concussions. With us today, Dr. Paul Berkner with the Maine Concussion Management Initiative at Colby College. Dr. Michelle Labatz, a sports medicine physician at Intermed. Laura McGrath, physical therapist with CAPE Physical Therapy. Won't you join our conversation? Give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to the phones and Elaine in Portland. Hi, Elaine, go ahead.
Yes, 14 years ago, I slipped on ice and fell on the back of my skull. My own doctor, my allopathic doctor, couldn't find anything wrong, but I knew of Dr. Kevin Zorsky, an osteopathic physician in Yarmouth, in Freeport. Well, I walked in with this cloudy head and feeling really strange, and I walked out free. He told me that the parietal bones had gotten jammed into the sphenoid bones, something like that. So I want to recommend osteopathic treatments can also help.
Huh, so that probably wasn't a concussion then, right?
I think he used the word mild concussion. That's probably why my own doctor couldn't find anything wrong, but I knew something was wrong. It was a mild concussion. He confirmed that.
Okay, Laura McGrath.
Well, I think this speaks to some of the soft tissue issues that can surround when your head impacts a hard surface. And you know, the cervical spine is the most mobile part of our spinal column. And when we hit our head on something hard, some of the forces get absorbed by that cervical spine. And some of the ligaments and structures can get damaged and injured. And the little muscles that go from vertebrae to vertebrae called your suboccipitals can get very tight and sort of guarding. And they can lead to some headaches because of the vertebral artery that runs and nerve that runs through these muscles. And so that's actually one of the roles we have in physical therapy, similar to osteopathic's role, is to kind of work to try to get those muscles to relax so that in case there's a cervical component or a neck pain component to the headaches, that's something that's absolutely worth looking into.
Elaine, thanks for your call. I'm going to go to a Facebook post from Martha. What is the expert's opinion on the timing of treatment of the various concussion symptoms? I'm a middle-aged woman who had a concussion 3 years ago. It wasn't until 14 months after my injury that I was finally assessed for vestibular issues and crystals were found to be out of place in my ears. If this had been discovered much earlier, would I have had a different or different recovery? I continue to experience various symptoms. Do you have a thought about, Laura, about timing?
Okay, so in a perfect world, I think when you get beyond 3 weeks and you're still having significant symptoms such as the headache or the dizziness or the balance issues we talked about, I think it's a very smart idea to seek out some physical therapy because we can kind of try to preempt any kind of chronic problem. And the crystal issue this woman's speaking of is really, she's talking about the vestibular system in the inner ear. And one of you might be able to speak more to that how that impact might actually cause some crystal dislodging and where the vestibular issue might override the concussion.
Sure. So to answer our first question is 3 years ago, we were doing things different than we are today. So 3 years ago, I would not have necessarily been initiating vestibular therapy early on. Right now, we're doing it as soon as within a very short window of time, probably a week to 10 days for those people who have vestibular symptoms. So if they have problems with dizziness, with balance, with their eye motion, then we'll refer them right over. 3 years ago, I would not have done that. Second of all, there are crystals that are formed or calcifications that occur in the labyrinth system. And so the breaking away of those is not uncommon. It actually happens spontaneously a lot of times. And there's a specific term for that called benign positional vestibular, BPVN.
Paroxysmal.
Yeah. Something like that.
Exactly. And there are some specific treatments for that. But that's not would not be common 3 years ago for me not to refer somebody to vestibular therapy. And I think that's the point of this show, is to have people understand that things are changing and that we as providers need to stay as current as we can around treatment.
So if Martha had this injury 3 years ago, would it benefit her still to have some physical therapy, Laura? Or all three of you are nodding. So
absolutely.
Yes, she shouldn't think it's too late, and it's not too late to seek out some help. We have an email from Paul. He writes, my daughter sustained a concussion a year ago and is a three-sport athlete. She loves soccer, and I have two questions. One, is there any research regarding heading a soccer ball and concussions? And two, and Paul, you kind of answered this one already, what are your thoughts about the use of protective headgear such as the full 90? I know, Michelle Labatz, you have done a lot of work about student athletes and different things, everything from trampolines to heading soccer balls. What are your thoughts?
So when we talk about the force across the brain with heading that is done appropriately, we call that a subconcussive impact. So there is some stress across the brain, but it doesn't rise to the level of a concussion. And I'll tell you, the jury is really still out in terms of the significance of that. There is some good data looking at some of the kind of the fancier imaging that they're doing in research on concussion that shows that, yeah, that if you are doing this consistently, that there is some changes in what they call the white matter of the brain that you can see kind of at that, again, almost that cellular level. But there's conflicting data in terms of how that affects function. There are some studies that show that if you go through a season of contact sport, that there is some effect on kind of cognitive and academic performance. And there's other studies that show the complete opposite, that there's really no effect. So I think there's good reason to kind of give pause for that, because when you see those changes at the structural level, you think, boy, it's at some point that might accumulate and become clinically significant. But right now, we don't really know what the clinical significance of it is. Okay. And then in terms of the headgear, you know, the Federal Trade Commission has actually gotten after some of those companies that were making a lot of claims online. So I think you'll see that that some of that stuff is actually going to go away.
It would be really great when it does. In fact, they have a helmet for your helmet now. So for your football helmet, they actually have a foam padding for your helmet. I'm not quite sure what it's supposed to do. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there that really has no, there is no evidence that it actually reduces. In fact, my worry about using the full 90 in soccer is that then the players then feel like they're safer. And they're not necessarily safer.
We have a related email from John in Orland. He writes, is there any way to protect football players from concussion? Any new technology? And I'm going to digress a little bit and tell a story that my father-in-law tells. He went to Chevres, and he was on the football team when they transitioned from the leather helmets to the kind of helmets they use today. And he talked about getting his new helmet, putting on his head, running into another player at full force on purpose because he could, and knocking himself out cold.
I think there are things we can do in football that will reduce concussions. They're about rules and about the way we officiate the game. They're about tackling techniques. I think that's one of the things we're really seeing changing. But I don't think we'll ever be able to reduce concussions to zero in life nor in football. I think that is one of the risks of football. To talk about, Dr. Labatz was talking about, is sort of these subconcussive blows. You know, that is the hottest thing right now in football. It's actually not the wide receivers, those people who get those catastrophic hits, that are at the greatest risk. They're the linemen. So the vast majority of people you've seen who've had what the CTE, this chronic traumatic encephalopathy, have been linemen. These people who are in what they call the pit all day, every day, hitting their head against other players. And so we really need to figure that thing out, because I think that will drastically change.
And they're talking about dozens or even hundreds of hits a week. So it's
Per practice.
So that's why you're hesitant to apply the information coming out of the NFL to a kid playing school sports.
And these players have been playing, first of all, they're faster, they're stronger. This is their profession. They've been hitting themselves since they were 8 years old. What is the long-term risk for that? No one knows. It's very difficult to take the NFL data and put it into the high school data. I do worry about people who've had multiple concussions. The soccer dad had, was that two concussions? Something. When we start looking at people who've had three or more concussions, I really start questioning whether they should be continuing to do the sport that they're doing. There is no really good data, except for I do think, as Dr. Labatz talked about earlier, the more concussions you get, the more likely you are to get another concussion, which then increases your risk for having long-term complications.
Okay, we're going to go to Falmouth and Jamie. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I'm a 20-year-old guy in Falmouth who got a concussion about 2 years ago in a surfing accident. And I've seen, over 20 different medical professionals. And I've been out of school since then. And I'm hoping to go back this fall. And I have seen some improvement, or actually quite a bit of improvement. But I guess largely, I've found a lot of what I've encountered in the medical community very unhelpful or just unknowledgeable. And that was mostly right after the injury. And for the past year or a little more than that, I haven't really seen very many people. And I guess I was wondering, I think I know there are still treatment options out there that I would very much like to try. I just want to get in contact with the right people. I was wondering if you guys had anything to say about that.
Well, the three guests on our show are pretty terrific people to contact, and they're all within driving distance of you, Jamie and Falmouth. His question kind of begs another question. How hard is it for pediatricians and primary care docs to keep up with what they need to know about concussions?
It's hard for anybody to keep up, as you were mentioning at the beginning of the show, Jennifer. I mean, every week there's new stuff coming out. And the hard thing about concussion is that, like we talked about earlier, there's kind of no clear delineation of are there different types of concussion that might have kind of different, treatment courses? Are there different degrees or grades that we are now not calling but may in the future be shown to be important? So we know what we know right now, and if we do this again in another year, what we say at that show is probably going to be very different than what we're saying now. Where was I going with this?
Well, how hard it is for pediatricians and primary care docs who are trying to keep up to the latest on all sorts of things to know what to do when you bring your child or you take yourself in because your head hurts.
Yeah. And no, it's very difficult, and the information is conflicting. You'll get studies that are done very similarly that will come to completely opposite conclusions. So it's a matter of kind of putting it all into the mix and just kind of, taking it on a case-by-case basis and looking at what are the symptoms that are sitting in front of you in the office, and then trying to figure out the best way to treat based upon those symptoms rather than having a one-size-fits-all kind of concussion treatment program. And that's where what I feel like I've really changed in the past year or two is really kind of individualizing and parsing out individual bits of treatment rather than having kind of a universal approach for all concussions.
All right.
That's also very frustrating for patients because they expect the same thing to happen all the time. Last thing to this caller is time is the greatest healer, and not getting another concussion is the real big risk. And then having him seek out help with somebody like Laura, who actually know a physical therapist who actually can engage him to try to reduce some of his symptoms.
All right. We're going to try to get in another call. We're going to go to Jacques in Waterville. Hi, Jacques. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Paul.
Jacques.
My question has to do with getting baselines. My youngest daughter, I guess when she was a sophomore in high school, she played soccer and basketball, and they recommended that she get a baseline brain scan, which was supposed to help diagnose a concussion. So you've had several years of data. Is it helpful to have the baseline?
So the question of baseline testing is right up in front of us today. There's a number of different ways to get baseline tested. You can get baseline balance tested. There's now an eye movement testing that requires baseline testing. But what you're talking about, Jock, I know, is impact testing. So it's not a brain scan. It's a neurocognitive testing tool. Three very There's lots of debate right now whether we need to do impact testing, or some debate about whether we do impact testing as a baseline. I'm a supporter of it for three reasons. One is it talks about the importance of concussions. It tells the athletes and their parents that this injury is significant enough that you have to take a test before you can participate in the sport so we can help you. Second of all, it gives us data around who they are so that when they do get a concussion, we can compare it directly to them. We don't have to look at norm data, so a whole population's data, to sort of say, yes, you have had a concussion. The third thing is it actually gives concrete information to those parents and those athletes who have significant changes to say, here's something concrete. It's not just about symptoms. It's not just about how you feel. Your memory has been significantly delayed from when it would change from when you took your baseline test. That's very powerful for parents to know. Lastly, is it also allows us to see when they're getting better. Is it a perfect test? No, it is absolutely not a perfect test. There are lots of people who don't like using impact testing. There are lots of different neurocognitive tests out there that are on the market. This is the one that we chose as an as a group to use because it, at that point in time and today, it probably has it is the best test that we have on the market today. It would be really wonderful when we can have a baseline test. I mean, a blood test. Sorry, not a baseline test, but a blood test that we can use. We're still a long way away from that.
Well, that's going to have to be the last question. Jacques, thank you so much for your call. Such an interesting conversation. Thank you all for being here today. Laura McGrath with CAPE Physical Therapy, Dr. Paul Berkner with the Maine Concussion Management Initiative at Colby College, and Dr. Michelle Labatt, sports medicine physician at InterMed. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. There you can also sign up for our podcast, which is available on iTunes. If you enjoyed today's program, consider sharing it. There is a link on our webpage that makes sharing our programs quick and easy. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, Senator George Mitchell joins us to discuss his memoir, The Negotiator, Reflections on American Life. Hope you'll join us for that. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, according to a new study, the number of Americans not affiliated with any religion now make up more than 20% of the population. The increase is especially pronounced among younger people. Causes and consequences of declining religious affiliation in the U.S.
Next time on The World, life or death for the Boston Marathon bomber. A federal jury will decide the fate of Johar Tsarnaev. This priest cites a higher authority.
I think the church, right on up to the Pope, would say, just because evil was done doesn't mean that we need to participate in the evil of taking someone's life.
What's God's position on the death penalty? That's on The World.
Join us at 3 o'clock this afternoon. And you are listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting. We are WMEW in Waterville on 91.3, WMED in Calais on 89.7, WMEF in Fort Kent on 106.5, WMEH in Bangor on 90.9, WMEP Camden 90.5, WMEM in Presque Isle on 106.1, WMEA Portland 90.1, and we're also online at mpbn.net. The Maine Public Broadcasting Network was founded by the University of Maine System and Colby, Bates, and Bowdoin Colleges. Coming up next, ideas on the CBC, the radio stations of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, strive to offer a diverse selection of voices and opinions on a wide array of issues in our daily 1 o'clock public affairs hour. The views and opinions offered at this time reflect those of the speaker or speakers. The fact that they're included here does not mean they're supported or endorsed by MPBN. Community support makes public affairs programming possible, together with the Maine law firm of Eaton Peabody.